come in still who are out.
So good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I was just informed that we're starting our sixth year of public forums. So I think we should give ourselves a good cheer. So the topic of the whole session this year is fighting cancer with knowledge and hope, which is what these forums are meant to be. Tonight, as you know, we have a full evening on lung cancer. And according to statistics that Dr. Agulnik will be discussing, as you will see, it's a very scary statistics. But Dr. Cohen and Dr. Wang will be telling us that there's hope, that there's a lot of work being done all over the world right now, some of it being done in our laboratory, in the Goodman Cancer Center. And we have a special guest tonight. There was a late breaking news in a major journal a couple of weeks ago by one of our teams from Dr. Russell Jones, who was supposed to be here, but somehow he's in Philadelphia. And we get a bonus because we actually get to hear the person, the postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Emma Vincent, who actually did the work. Rusty just wrote about it. Got the money, okay. Before we actually begin with the scientific talks, I'd like to present to you, you know her, you've seen her, she's all over the place, Dr. Morag Park, director of the Goodman Cancer Center.
So I too would like to welcome you this evening and to thank both Nicole and Annette and all the speakers who come to these sessions, both for organizing the forum and for championing them. And this, as Nicole said, is the first forum of this year's season. But what's important is that this structure, the forum, has been copied now by many other organizations. And what I wanted to highlight here is that there's going to be the biggest cancer meeting held in Canada is in Montreal this weekend. This is a scientific meeting, but it's about all aspects of cancer, quality of life, outcome, clinical trials, as well as the fundamental research that we do. But in addition to scientific sessions, there will be an evening on Monday night which will provide forum in exactly this type of structure. And I've put out some flyers that are outside, and we can leave them outside for when you leave. The information is on the flyers. These are open to everybody. So what you'll see in this slide is that there are, at 6 o'clock, there will be specific, There's going to be different forum being held at the same time on different subjects. So there'll be a lung cancer one, a brain cancer, prostate cancer. These will last for about 45 minutes in the same type of format as we have here. You'll be able to ask questions. So if you're interested, you could choose any one of these. In addition, there's going to be a single, what we call plenary forum on immunotherapy. This is going to be in a large room, up to 800 people. And the Goodman Cancer Center sponsored the immunotherapy forum, and we did that specifically because there are a whole wave of new treatments that you'll see in the newspapers and on the TV, and many of these are called immunotherapy. And our second forum in this sequence series will be on immunotherapy. But we wanted to provide this information to a large audience to give you the opportunity to understand what are we talking about? What are the newspapers talking about? What are we hearing on the TV about immunotherapy? We hear about big successes, but there are always challenges. So what is this immunotherapy? Now, what's exciting about that is that after all of these, this should finish by about 7:30. There's going to be a one-hour sort of meet and greet where the people that are presenting in all of the different forum and researchers will be available to discuss. There will be a bit of a cocktail, cheese and wine, some nibbles where you can talk to one another or talk to researchers specifically about different areas of cancer. So if you are interested, please come on Monday evening. And this is to the, Hotel Bonaventure on La Gauchetière. You can turn up on the night, but for the smaller forum, they may be full up. So if you are interested, try and go on the web and register. For the large immunotherapy forum, there will be plenty space for everybody. We'd love to see you. You can ask questions. You'll get an idea of what's going on. And then you can follow up in our next forum that we'll be holding here. So thank you very much, and thank you for supporting us. This is for you, and we really enjoy our ability to be able to talk to you and engage with you and get your questions back to us. And I think it's a learning process both for us as well as yourself. So thanks again.
As you might notice, they changed the system. After 25 years of struggling with this podium and its antiquated system, this summer, a gift, they changed it. It's fast, it works. Now I'm trying to get them to change the carpet. Okay. So the session for tonight, as you know, breathing new life into lung cancer treatments. We can't do without lungs. We really need them. They're very precious. Yet, when we get an infection, when we are suffocated by smoke, or, unfortunately, when we get lung cancer, we realize how important lungs are. As you know, my name is Nicole Bouchemin. I think I've been doing this for 4 years. Most likely. I followed in sequence from Michel Tremblay, whom you all remember, I'm sure. I'm a professor here in the Goodman Cancer Center. My specialty is colorectal cancer, but I have another specialty. I'm a breast cancer survivor. So we know what we're talking about. Our first speaker tonight is Dr. Jason Agolnik. Dr. Agolnik is a graduate of McGill University. He did his medical degree here in 1993. He went on to do a pulmonary fellowship again at McGill. And then he moved over to Université de Montréal at Notre Dame Hospital, where he did another fellowship in interventional bronchoscopy. From there on, he moved to the Dana-Farber Institute at Harvard to study thoracic oncology. He then came back to Montreal, where he's now an assistant professor of medicine in the Department of Internal Medicine at the Jewish General Hospital. He's also the Associate Chief Division of Pulmonary Disease in the Department of Internal Medicine, and he's the Medical Director of Pulmonary Oncology. So let's welcome tonight Dr. Jason Agolnik. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Or just push the arrows?
You're a PC person anyway.
Yeah. Okay. No. I just want to make sure. Okay. Well, thank you to the Goodman Cancer Center for inviting me. I'm just going to briefly mention my disclosures that I've given talks and done consulting for the following companies. For those of you who are not familiar, I work at the Jewish General Hospital. And here's an image, and we have the Siegel Cancer Center, which is about almost 10 years old now. And up on the 10th floor, we have our Peter Boji Lung Cancer Center, which is almost 4 years old. And it's a nice dedicated space just for the lung cancer patients. It's quite appropriate that they organize a lung cancer talk today in November, because November happens to be Lung Cancer Awareness Month. Most of you have probably heard of Movember for prostate. Unfortunately, lung cancer does not get the same press. And I'm going to just self-promote our center that basically we were just talking about immunotherapy 2 minutes ago, but next week we have a free public lecture on immunotherapy. We have Dr. Jerry Butts, Charlie Butts, from he's a renowned oncologist in Edmonton, and he's going to come and give a talk on immunotherapy. Can we cure advanced lung cancer? So that's at the Jewish General Hospital 1 week from now. So today I'm going to talk about statistics of lung cancer, risk factors, screening for lung cancer, diagnostic tests, and staging of lung cancer. So to go through the statistics, so lung cancer, if you look, there's new cases. There's approximately 26,000 new cases per year. And if you look here at the deaths, there's estimated over 20,000 deaths per year in Canada from lung cancer. These statistics are from the Canadian Cancer Society and Health Canada. And here, if you just look, this is from 2011 data showing that cancer is the number one cause of death, almost 30% of causes of death. If you look at incidence of cancers, so on the left you have men, on the right you have females, and let me just get this pointer working. So lung cancer is the second most common cancer in women, over 13%. And in men, actually I was surprised to see this, it just recently became the third. It used to be the second. So it just dropped below colorectal. So prostate is the most common type of cancer in men. And in women, it's breast cancer, but lung cancer is high up there. And here you can see that in men, the incidence, so the number of new cases per year, has been slowly dropping. It's the blue line there. And so it just dropped below colorectal cancer. In women, you can see that it's gone up, and it's hopefully just peaking and on its way down now. If you look, on the other hand, at cancer deaths in all people, and you separate the men and the women, you see that lung cancer is the number one cause of death in both men and women. And you can see here that it's over two times as common as colorectal in men, almost 2.5 times more common than prostate in men, And in women, it's twice as common as breast cancer. And here you could see the trends in men, and you could see that lung cancer is by far much more common as the cause of death than any of the other cancers. And in women, it continues to go up, and hopefully it's going to start to trend downwards. And I found the following slide very interesting. When they break it up according to age groups, when you look at patients over 70, lung cancer is the most common cause of death, also over 50. But even when you look at the 30 to 50-year-old range, lung cancer is the most common cause, breast being number two. So it's not just a disease of older patients. This is looking at the 5-year survival of different cancers, and on the top you could see that you have prostate cancer, breast cancer, colorectal, and down here is lung cancer. And you're looking here at 5 years, the percent of patients who were initially diagnosed who are still alive. And unfortunately with lung cancer, the statistics are very poor. The majority of patients are diagnosed when they have advanced cancer, and there's no, up until recently, no good screening mechanisms. As some may be aware, for prostate you can do blood tests, breast cancer you could do mammograms, colon cancer, you could go for colonoscopies. And this, again, is comparing 1992 data to 2006 data. And you can see the comparison that lung cancer is all the way down here. And it's less than 20% 5-year survival. It's even lower. It's probably about 10 to 15% for all comers. And this slide I found very interesting in that if you split up lung cancer into patients who smoked and lung cancer in non-smokers, lung cancer in non-smokers is the 7th most common cause of cancer death worldwide. So it's not just a smoker's disease either. It's more common to see women who had never smoked getting lung cancer, and almost 1/5 of lung cancers in the women are in patients who never smoked. And it's almost equal to the same amount of patients who are diagnosed with cervical or thyroid cancer in the U.S. So if we look at just Quebec statistics, again, like I mentioned, prostate is the most commonly diagnosed cancer. About 4,600 men will be diagnosed with it. 4,300 men will be diagnosed with lung cancer. But when you look at the cause of death, it's almost 2.5 times more common than the next one, lung cancer deaths. 3,500 men will die approximately in 2015. compared to less than 1,000 for prostate cancer. So they've made good strides with a lot of cancers. Unfortunately, lung cancer, they've made a lot of recent small strides, which Dr. Cohen will discuss, but still a lot more needs to be done. And in women, again, 6,100 will be diagnosed with breast cancer in the province of Quebec, 4,000 with lung cancer. And when you're looking at what patients will unfortunately die of, lung cancer is the number one cause. This is from 2013, but I thought that the title was interesting, that although it kills more Canadians than any other disease, research and health support are poorly funded. And they mentioned that only 7% of cancer-specific research funding and under 1% of cancer donations are given for lung cancer. So I'm going to mention the risk factors for lung cancer. The number one cause is smoking. Number two is smoking. Three is smoking. But there are patients who never smoke. There's secondhand smoke, which is very hard to quantify. Radon is thought to be the second leading cause of cancer death, of lung cancer. And then there's a lot of other smaller causes. But again, smoking is really the number one cause. There's asbestos exposure, radiation exposure, silicosis, arsenic, and some maybe perhaps genetic factors. I never give a lung cancer talk without briefly mentioning smoking and the importance of quitting smoking. I found this diagram on the internet, and I thought it was quite an interesting image because it goes through all the different ingredients in a cigarette, and none of them individually would you ever put in your mouth. There are a lot of very good smoking cessation programs available in Quebec and in Montreal. There's one at the Jewish. It's free. But there's also a website for the CLSC's I Quit Now, which also talks about different resources available to help people quit smoking. For radon, you can go through Health Canada or the Lung Association, and there's different kits you could purchase at different places to test your house for radon. So screening for lung cancer. So like I mentioned, other diseases have good screening mechanisms, such as breast cancer, colon cancer, and prostate cancer. Well, what about lung cancer? Several studies were done over the past several decades looking at sputum analysis, chest x-rays, and none of them showed any significant improvement. In 2011, there was a study that was published in the New England Journal, which showed that there was reduced lung cancer mortality with low-dose CT scans. And the conclusion of the study was an extremely large study looking at tens of thousands of patients that screening with the use of low-dose CT reduces mortality from lung cancer. And they were able to find earlier lung cancers, and they were able to send them for surgery. And if you look here, these are the number of lung cancers. So the study compared low-dose CT, which is the top line here, compared to a chest x-ray. Chest x-ray is not routinely done, but in the study it was. And you could see they found much more lung cancer in this group with the CTs. They were early stage, which I'm going to talk about soon. And when you looked at mortality, there was less mortality in the CT scanning group, meaning less patients died. So what are the current recommendations? So there are no Canadian recommendations to have lung cancer screening. We're always slightly behind the time. But there's a lot of U.S. associations that have come out with screening guidelines. And it's taken mostly from the article, and it recommends to screen high-risk individuals. So who is a high-risk individual? The age, it depends on which guideline you're looking at, but it's usually 55 to 75 or 55 to 80. People who have had a considerable amount of smoking history, so a minimum of 30 pack years. A pack year is considered how many years you smoked multiplied by the number of packs per day. So someone who smokes 20 years, two packs per day, is considered a 40-pack year smoker. And then it's patients who are either current smokers or have quit within the last 15 years. And the recommendations are that they get an annual CT, low-dose CT, for 3 years. Obviously, if things are picked up, they may require further and more investigations. So what are the different diagnostic tests we have for lung cancer? So often when a patient presents, so either they can present asymptomatic, meaning they have no symptoms, and it's found by accident on an x-ray because the patient was sent before they're undergoing surgery, or they underwent an x-ray or scan for another purpose. They had abdominal pain, had a CT scan of the abdomen, and they found a spot in the lungs. So they may be sent for further x-rays, scans. You can have CAT scans, MRI scans. MRIs are not used to look at the lungs, but they could be used to look at other organs such as the brain or the abdomen. Or PET scans, which is a nuclear study which looks for cancer or cells that turn over quickly, and it gives you whether something is hot or cold. And or you can have bone scans. And then you could do other tests that are nonspecific. But then finally and ultimately, you need to undergo a biopsy of some sort. And the reason you have to undergo a biopsy is to get a diagnosis. You need a piece of tissue so that the pathologist could look at it and tell us what type of cancer it is. the first thing to always differentiate is this truly a lung cancer, or is this another cancer that has spread to the lungs? If you happen to have a colon cancer or a breast cancer and it's spread to the lungs, it's treated very differently than a lung cancer. So you want to know if it's metastatic or if it's primary lung. And within lung, there's different types of cancers also. So the patient may undergo either a bronchoscopy, thoracentesis, which is sticking a needle in case the patient has fluid and you can remove the fluid. There's CT-guided biopsies done by the radiologist. And then the surgeons can do different types of surgical techniques, a mediastinoscopy, whereby they stick a small camera, they make a small incision just below the sternum, and they stick a camera in and then grab a piece of a lymph node, or a surgical biopsy, an open lung biopsy. This is what a bronchoscope looks like. This is the end here or here. There's a little light source. There's a small little working channel, and you can put a little bit of forceps out to take a little piece of tissue or a needle. And often you take that and you would sedate the patient. It's usually done with conscious sedation. And so these are the vocal cords. This is the main airway, the trachea. You have the right lung and the left lung. And you can take it and go down into a few subsegments and take a look. Sometimes if the lesion you can't see, if it's too peripheral or distant from where you are, you can put some fluid in and suck it back and try to get some cells. Often you may go in and see a tumor in the airway and you can biopsy it and then send that for pathology. Sometimes you get lymph nodes that are outside the airway, and what you would then do is stick a needle. You can stick it directly where you think the lymph node is. And just to give you an example, so lymph nodes are throughout the body. You have them in your neck down to your legs. When you get a cold, you often feel that your glands are swelling in your neck or your lymph nodes. So these are also throughout the chest. And so this is the main airway again. This is the right lung and the left lung. And there are lymph nodes, different chains that go throughout the whole airways, throughout the respiratory system. And depending what lymph nodes are enlarged, usually we measure them at 1 centimeter to be large, then you could biopsy them. The other techniques to biopsy is called endobronchial ultrasound. So this is a bigger bronchoscope with an ultrasound right at the edge here. And you put that against the airway. And what you would see is then you could see the lymph node outside the airway, and you would stick a needle directly into it and get a sample. And down here, so the scope would be on the top here, and this is the lymph node here, and the needle is the little white line here going directly into the lymph node. So you can directly visualize the biopsy. And gastroenterologists can also do this with an endoscopic ultrasound, undergoing a gastroscopy. So they would stick it into the esophagus, and they could look through the esophagus at the different lymph nodes that are enlarged and stick a needle. And we pick and choose depending on which lymph nodes are enlarged and which ones are easiest accessible by different techniques. Other technique is a transthoracic needle aspiration. So this is a CT-guided biopsy. It can also be an ultrasound-guided biopsy done by the radiologist, whereby they would stick a needle directly into a tumor. So this is the right lung, that's the left lung, and this white area here is abnormal, and this is the needle going directly into it. Other biopsy possibilities are the adrenal gland, the bones, the liver, the lymph nodes. So you basically have to assess on which one is most easily accessible and which one can get you the best tissue. And tissue is very important, as Dr. Cohen's going to talk about, on different types of mutations. And the more tissue you have, the more analysis you could do with the biopsies. And this is a thoracentesis. So, again, this is the lung, and the lining of the lung is called the pleura. And sometimes you can get fluid in this space. It's called a pleural effusion. And you could stick a needle directly in and then remove the fluid for analysis. And then you can send the patient to a surgeon sometimes so they can biopsy the lymph nodes with the mediastinoscopy, or there's different types of lung biopsies. And they do now what's called a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery. So instead of making a large incision, which they used to do, they put 3 small incisions. One's a camera, and the other 2 are working channels, and they can actually go in, and through a monitor they do surgery, and they can take a small piece of tissue. They can even remove the lung cancer, so you can undergo a lobectomy this way also. And the whole goal is to get the pathology. So you want to find out, is this metastatic disease or lung cancer? There are 2 main types. One is called non-small cell, and the other is called small cell. And it's basically what it looks like under the microscope. But then the pathologist will then do special stains to then be certain that it's one or the other. And within the non-small cell, there's different types. There's adenocarcinoma, squamous cell, and large cell, and you can get mixes of them also. And the treatments are different for the non-small cell and the small cell, and the small cells tend to be a bit more aggressive. And you could see that the non-small cells are the most common, probably over 80%. And of those, the most common of those is the adenocarcinoma, which is over half of those, probably about two-thirds. And the small cells are less common. The small cells are almost always caused by smoking. The adenocarcinomas are the cancer most commonly seen in non-smokers. And finally, I'm going to talk about staging. So the staging system has gone through multiple revisions. And actually, it's based on TNNM, so the tumor size, lymph node stations, and whether there's metastatic disease. So the T is split into four different Ts, T1 to T4, and they get larger. So T1 are tumors less than 3 centimeters, T2 is 3 to 7, T3 is greater than 7, and T4 are the tumors that tend to invade the major structures. The lymph node stations go from 0 to 3, and 1 is the lymph nodes in the same lung, within the lung, and 2 is when it starts to get into the middle of the chest, the mediastinum, on the same side, and N3 is when it crosses to the other side. And with the M, it's either M0 or M1, whether there is or isn't metastases. And based on all this, you get this, you basically try to calculate what the stage is. And it's quite complicated. Most of us still carry little pocket cheat sheets sometimes when we sit down to figure it out, because sometimes there's subtle differences between the different ones. But you could see a stage 1 would be a small lung cancer with no lymph node involvement. A stage 2 would be either a larger lung cancer with no lymph nodes or a small lung cancer with local lymph nodes. Stage 3 is when the lymph nodes have spread to the middle of the chest. And stage 4 is when you have distant metastases or to the other lung. And just to show you with illustrations, so this would be considered a stage 1 lung cancer, where you have a small tumor in the lung. Here it would be the right lung. These are the lymph node stations, and they're all clean. A stage 2 is where it would spread just to a local lymph node station within the lung. The 3 is split up into 3A, 3B. But again, the 3A would be the lymph nodes on the same size. So this is considered the mediastinum here, the middle of the chest. So either the subcarinal station or just underneath the splitting of the airways here, or one that's right next to the trachea on the same side, or it can either spread to the other side, so this is 3B, or above the other lymph node stations above the clavicle. And then finally, stage 4 is when it's spread to other organs, so either the other lung, the brain, the liver, or the adrenals. Now, statistics are not great for lung cancer. But I want to just say a few things, is that a lot of this data is based on old data from over 10 years ago, and the scans that we're doing currently are much better, and so the patients, often the diagnosis and the staging system currently is better, and probably if you have a 1A, it's probably higher than 73%. Also, we've had a lot of big strides in treatments, which Dr. Cohen will soon talk about. And just a quick overview of treatment, the reason it's important to differentiate the different stages is because the treatments are all different. So a stage 1 or 2, the patient would often be referred for surgery, plus or minus chemotherapy. Stage 3s, they'd often get combined chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Stage 4s, we'd often offer some systemic chemotherapy or systemic therapy or a targeted therapy or personalized treatment. So in conclusion, lung cancer is the top killer in both men and women. Quitting smoking is the best prevention you can do. And if you know anyone, you can suggest that they get referred to one of the smoking cessation programs or contact the CLSC. Lung cancer screening is available for high-risk patients. It can be done. The hospitals do low-dose CT scans. A low-dose CT scan, by the way, is about one-fifth the radiation dose of a regular CT scan. It's important to get good tissue for pathology and molecular testing. And there still is a big problem with resources and funding for lung cancer. It's very hard to get a lot of press and a lot of attention. And I was also going to mention there is a Lung Cancer Canada organization. They tend to be very Ontario-centric, but they do have a lot of resources, mostly in English. They do have some French resources too. So if anyone looking for more information, they may be able to help you. I'm not going to answer any questions now. I'm going to do it after, I think, the end of the talk. Thank you.
Yeah. 68 in 19 minutes.
Dr. Park just reminded me that you should be aware that the meeting that's being held next Monday evening will also be in French. So don't worry if you are a Francophone. It's not just English-centric. It is also French. So some speakers are Anglophone, some speakers are Francophone. Question and answer will be in both. Okay. A little bit like here. So if you're wondering why we don't have questions immediately and you're a newcomer to the forum, good evening. You have cue cards in your pockets or whatever we gave you, and you have pencils. Whatever questions you have, you write them down, and at the end we will have some volunteers collect the questions, and the speakers will be coming up here and we'll ask the questions, and you'll get the answers you want. Thank you, Dr. Gomez. So our next speaker is Dr. Victor Cohen, who is also a McGill graduate for his medical degree and his residency in medical oncology. After completing this, he went on to the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, to do a specialty training at this institution. He then came back and joined the Jewish General Hospital Oncology Department in 2002. Since then, he's been specializing on treatment of lung and breast cancer. His work on lung cancer has been on a very important receptor that's called the epidermal growth factor receptor. And he's used this and exploited the therapeutic relevance to lung cancer. And so it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Cohen to speak to us tonight.
Thank you. Being in this room again brings back a lot of memories. I think last time I was here was 20 years ago, probably falling asleep. Listening to a biochemistry lecture.
No. You can't fall asleep in a biochemistry lecture.
So I was asked to talk about treatments and focus on personalization of care. Since we are very young. Moms and dads always remind us that we're very unique in many different ways. We're very special. And this is true for more than just personality. Each person has a distinct characteristic or characteristics that define his or her physiology. And it's a given that the human body is very complex, and so it's no surprise that nature of disease, when people become ill, from onset, development, course, and response to treatment, can be just as unique. And so imagine, what if your medical treatment could be as unique as you? Imagine, what if your cancer treatment could be as unique as you? And so this concept really is the essence of personalization of care. A treatment that is unique to a unique individual. And therefore, when we think about personalization of care, the aim is to have treatments that are tailored specifically to a patient's individual needs, based often on genetic information. And the goals and the expectations of these treatments are to improve outcomes and reduce the side effects of therapy. And with our rapidly expanding knowledge of the human genome, the study of our genes, this is steadily becoming a reality. And lung cancer is a great example of personalized medicine. In fact, lung cancer is the poster child for precision medicine, and I'll explain to you why. So Dr. Ogalnik already mentioned the role that our pathologists play in the diagnosis of this disease. He mentioned that doctors can tell the types of lung cancers apart by looking at biopsy specimens under a microscope. Historically, you've seen this pie chart already. Historically, we think of lung cancer as two major types, small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. And non-small cell lung cancer being by far the most common type among these two. And then we also classified these non-small cell lung cancers into different types. These include the adenocarcinoma, the squamous cancers, the large cell cancers, and the other category. With among these subtypes of lung cancer, adenocarcinoma being the most common. So this was our view of lung cancer not long ago. Even 10 or maybe 10, 15 years ago, this is how we thought about lung cancer. And so this description sounds simple. Two major types, three different subtypes. But a better understanding of tumor biology, and this is an understanding that's come from amazing research work that's been carried out over the past 10, 15, 20 years. Based on a better understanding of tumor biology, we recognize that lung cancer is not simple, but rather complicated, particularly from the molecular or genetic standpoint. And this has really transformed the way doctors interpret or think about lung cancer. And so instead of just thinking in broad categories, now us and pathologists use a tumor's molecular profile or genetic makeup to reclassify lung cancer. So it's not just non-small cell lung cancer, or it's not just adenocarcinoma, but now we talk about entities listed by molecular descriptions according to the predominant genetic change. And so the old pie chart becomes the new pie chart, where we further classify or subclassify tumors. So again, we no longer talk about, say, adenocarcinoma, but we talk about adenocarcinoma that has a specific genetic change, like adenocarcinoma EGFR mutated, adenocarcinoma KRAS mutated, adenocarcinoma ALK rearranged. And this is going to be our language as we move forward in taking care of patients with lung cancer. And this new way of looking at lung cancer has also transformed the way doctors treat the disease. And as I've already mentioned, lung cancer is very rich in molecular complexities and spurred by different molecular pathways. This means that we now are able to identify pathways. These are cell pathways that drive growth and survival of cancer cells, and we've been able to identify these pathways, some unique to particular tumor types. And now that we recognize that these pathways are very important for these tumor cells, we exploit these unique pathways. Sometimes they're often referred to as weak spots, to develop very precise or targeted therapies. And what do we mean by that? So if a cancer cell has a dominant pathway that it's using to survive, then by targeting this pathway or turning it off, this treatment that we are giving to our patients becomes a true Achilles heel. And when we talk about these weak spots, many weak spots have been found in many genes. One example of this, one example of a weak spot is the epidermal growth factor receptor gene, or EGFR for short. Now, the story of EGFR is really an amazing story, and it goes back to 2004, and it very much illustrates the concept of personalized medicine, personalized therapy in the treatment of lung cancer. So about 12, 13, 14 years ago, we recognized that there may be a weak spot that's yet to be identified in lung cancer cells that would make them appropriate for precision treatment. And the focus was on the EGFR gene. We knew that that gene was important for lung cancer cells because it helped cells grow and divide. And so companies developed a class of drugs called tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs, that block the signal. And the hope was that this treatment would stop tumors from growing. And when we tested these new drugs in clinical trials, we realized that there was a problem. We had a lot of high expectations for these drugs, but we quickly learned that it was only some patients, not all patients, or not even the majority of patients, responded to these therapies. And we didn't know why. So we knew that these drugs worked in lung cancer. We just didn't know how to use them. Who would be the best people? Who are those people that are most likely to benefit from these drugs? We didn't really know. And when we looked back at these trials to figure out, and sort of studied these exceptional cases of who really responded to these drugs, we found out that they had, all these people had some commonalities, and similar features included those patients who were Asian, those patients who were female, and those patients who were never or light smokers. And so scientists asked the question, there must be an explanation for this. And they asked a very important question, or at least thought about the concept of the possibility of a genetic explanation. So something in a tumor, genetic changes could maybe explain this profile of you know, women, non-smokers, Asian, that saw these patients responding to these therapies. And sure enough, that's really what we found out. So in some ways we got lucky, but what we discovered was a mutation in this gene that rendered these tumors particularly vulnerable to these kinds of drugs. So this was, so in other words, a mutation in this gene resulted in these tumor cells dividing and growing over and over. And like I've mentioned already, the Achilles heel concept is that for this particular very special type of lung cancer, the targeting this mutation with these new drugs that we've developed shut off tumor growth, and the tumor shrank sometimes in a very dramatic way. And this is just one of many examples where precision therapy translated into prolonging survival of our lung cancer patients, where now we have many, many patients who are living many, many years, even with metastatic disease, on these very special medications. Other weak spots that have been discovered include KRAS and ALK genetic changes. ALK specifically, the ALK gene, does also have a precision treatment targeted to it. So just like EGFR has the special TKIs, so too the ALK gene can be targeted by similar kinds of medications. And so, obviously, with these discoveries, it became logical or reasonable to think that we needed to test tumors. So we have to test tumors for these mutations so that we can identify patients who would have the best chance of responding to these personalized therapies. And so a variety of drugs have been developed for these tumor weak spots, including gefitinib or Iressa for EGFR and crizotinib or Xalkori for ALK. And these are only two of many, many drugs that have been developed for these very special types of mutations. And so a very important message that we need to share, and that we even want to share not just with our colleagues but with our patients and the public, is that molecular testing for lung tumors now is the standard of care. It is no longer acceptable to just have a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer without doing these special tests. These special tests, or the molecular tests that we do, are recommended for the most part for lung adenocarcinomas. So all lung adenocarcinomas should be tested for these genetic mutations. For the most part, we focus on testing for EGFR and ALK. What's really remarkable is that even with these recommendations, not all patients are being tested. The testing is available, and patients should talk to their physicians about molecular testing, must demand molecular testing in many ways when they have a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer. One of the challenges is getting enough tissue during biopsy for molecular testing. This is something that we always struggle with. The challenge arises because the tumors are sometimes very small or might be in a part of the body that is very difficult to access. And so patients need to be aware that an additional biopsy might be useful for molecular testing. And it's important for people to know that it is worthwhile sometimes even to take that extra step, because the molecular information will be key to providing us with very important information with regards to both prognosis as well as treatments for the disease. On the horizon are other new treatments for lung cancer that I think eventually will become a part of personalized care. And it's been mentioned already, but one strategy of treatments that we're very excited about is that of immunotherapy. And immunotherapy involves a number of treatment modalities, all having what they have in common is that these therapies are using the patient's own immune system to attack the tumors, which obviously quite different from the conventional treatments that we have. And as I've already mentioned, there are multiple types of cancer immunotherapies. It's very hard to describe in simple terms exactly how they work, but I will try. And what we've learned, again, based on better understanding of how lung cancers grow, we found out that there are things called immune checkpoint inhibitors checkpoints that I'll be speaking about, and we've developed inhibitors against these checkpoints that can potentially, now we talk about potentially curing multiple types of cancers. And these types of drugs have been drawing a lot of attention. A lot of commercials now are on TV, Optivo commercials, longer life Optivo commercials that are almost always on TV almost every single night, simply because I guess a reflection of how important these molecules are and how excited we are about incorporating these treatments into the standard management of lung cancer. So how do these treatments work? So the immune system attacks tumor cells while sparing normal cells. That's the idea. Now, the problem is that the immune system often doesn't do a good job of identifying these tumor cells. It's difficult sometimes for the immune system to differentiate between tumor self, or rather tumor cell and self. And we've identified checkpoint proteins on these cells that act as on-off switches. And they can activate immune they can activate the immune system to determine whether a cell is tumor cell or normal. And remarkably, what we've learned is that the tumors have actually hijacked the system. So what they've learned to do is they've learned to hide from the immune system, and the way that they do that is they play on these checkpoints, whereby they do a variety of things, secrete substances, certain things happen to these tumor cells so that they could so that they can turn off the immune system and essentially get away from the immune system finding them and killing them. And it's very much like them putting on a mask or a camouflage jacket. They're there, but the immune system can't see them. And so when the immune system can't see them, then they have the ability to divide and grow without any checks or balances. And so what these new treatments are actually doing are turning on that switch. They're turning back on that switch that's been turned off by the tumor cells to activate the immune system. And in lung cancer, it's very rare that we get excited about therapies, because a lot of times we get very disappointed. But we are very, very excited about these class of molecules, because I think they're going to really be big game changers. And the results so far have been extremely, extremely promising. Results or responses in our lung cancer patients, at least some of our patients, are very impressive. Not only that, those people who respond for a long, long period of time. Long period of time. You know, when we talk about lung cancer, usually we talk about time in weeks or a few months, but here we are talking about patients having benefit for many, many months, sometimes even years, which was completely unheard of not long ago for patients with lung cancer. And these medications are available today, and they will be very, very soon. They will be so now they're available for our patients, but eventually they will be commercially available, where we can prescribe them to our patients. And one day, very, very soon, when I say very soon, meaning even the next year, they're going to be replacing standard chemotherapy and becoming the new standard of care for many of our patients with non-small cell lung cancer. Other types of so the immune checkpoint inhibitors are by far the most studied, but there are other types of immune therapies that are also being developed, including vaccine therapy. And over the next several years, there will be steps taken to engineer fully personalized immunotherapy vaccines based on each individual patient's extracted tumor cells. So vaccines special just for that particular patient. And there is a vaccine now that is used for the most part in the United States for patients with metastatic prostate cancer, but that concept is quickly evolving, and there is no doubt that eventually this will be a treatment options for patients with lung cancer as well. And these fully personalized vaccines will be injected back into the patients to fight against the remaining tumor cells in their body. And the promise of immunotherapy is greater than ever before, and the future looks really, really bright. So I hope Dr. Galnick's talk was to present the facts, and unfortunately, these facts reflect statistics that are very disappointing in some ways. And I hope that with my talk, and maybe even with speaker right after me who's going to talk about other aspects of lung cancer. I hope that we shared with you our high hopes and expectations, all the good things that are going to come for lung cancer in the next little while. So yes, lung cancer is still a devastating diagnosis. There is no doubt about it. But precision or personalized therapies based on genetic discoveries that I've talked about are converting lung cancer from a quickly fatal disease to a chronic disease where patients are living with metastatic lung cancer for many, many years. But now the bar is set even higher. Now with these other treatments, including the immunotherapies, the hope and the expectations are that these therapies will allow us to achieve the long-sought goal of cure even in patients with metastatic cancer. So we never talked about curing metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. If somebody talked about curing non-small cell lung cancer, people would think we were crazy. But now it might be very possible in the near future to reach this new reality. So I'm going to stop here, and we'll take questions after.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen, for this very exciting talk. So now, it seems like there's hope, but we still need to keep on looking because it's gotten a lot more complex. And when things are complex, there's never always just one answer. So we have our next speaker is a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory of Russell Jones. Rusty is a specialist in cancer metabolism. So this is how the cancer cell use the food and the surroundings to grow. So the basic idea is if you can cut out the food, you can stop the tumor. Easier said than done. Emma is a graduate student from the University of Nottingham in the UK. Then she moved down to Bristol to do graduate studies. And she's been in Canada for 3 years in the laboratory of Rusty Jones, Dr. Emma Vincent.
Okay, thanks, Nicole. And I'd like to say it's a real pleasure to be here to be able to tell you about the work I've been doing on lung cancer metabolism. Thanks. Okay, so for a tumor cell to grow and to divide, it needs to be able to generate all the cellular building blocks to build a new cell. And it also needs to generate the energy to build that cell. So you can see here as the tumor cell divides and gets bigger and bigger and the tumor grows. So in order to do this, it needs to take on nutrients or food to feed itself, as Nicole said. And so in the lab, we study how cancer cells fuel themselves and the metabolism that they use to do this. So we study this in the hope that we might be able to find new ways of targeting this metabolism, so targeting the way that the cancer cell is feeding itself, in the hope that we might be able to contribute to future cancer therapy. So one of the major nutrients or food sources that cancer cells use is glucose. They use glucose to generate these cellular building blocks and the energy that they need to make them. So the thing is with glucose is that it's not always readily available. So you can see here in this growing tumor that the cells in the middle of the tumor might not have that great a blood supply and therefore not a great supply of glucose. Even when the tumor has a blood supply, this can be quite an unordered and uneven process and leave areas of the tumor that don't have a good blood supply and therefore don't have good access to glucose. So what happens when glucose isn't available? So this is what we've been looking at in the lab. So we've been growing cancer cells in culture, and we've been looking at how the cancer cells grow, we've been looking at increasing cancer cell number over time. So here you can see that these lung cancer cells are growing and dividing rapidly, and their number is increasing over time. And these cancer cells are grown in the presence of glucose. So when we take glucose away, the cancer cells are still able to grow and divide. And you can see again that their cancer cell number is increasing over time. It's not until we take away another important nutrient called glutamine, which is actually a part of protein, that cancer cells will fail to grow and divide. So what we found in our study is that cancer cells are able to use glutamine to compensate for lack of glucose. So they use glutamine so that they can continue to proliferate when glucose is absent. And we found that they do this by using the activity of a protein called PCK2. So when lung cancer cells are grown in the absence of glucose, if they have PCK2, they do just fine. But if the cancer cell doesn't have PCK2, you can see that they really struggle to grow and divide in the absence of glucose. So when glucose is present, the cancer cell is able to use both glucose and glutamine to build the cellular building blocks and generate the energy needed to grow and divide. When glucose is absent, we found that cancer cells are able to use the nutrient glutamine so that they can continue to make the cellular building blocks and energy that they need to continue to grow and divide. So they compensate for the lack of glucose with glutamine. And we found that they're able to do that by using the activity of PCK2. And when the cancer cells don't have PCK2, they're then not able to build the cellular building blocks and generate energy, and therefore tumor growth would reduce. So this raises the exciting possibility of targeting PCK2 to treat lung cancer. We also found that PCK2 levels are elevated in patient lung cancer samples. This shows that perhaps our research would be clinically relevant. While what we do is very basic research, and so it's very early days, but we're excited about looking at the role of PCK2 in lung cancer further. And this is a list of everyone involved in the study, and thank you for listening.
So this study was published in a well-read journal in the field called Molecular Cell, and this came out about a couple of weeks ago. And so Emma is pursuing these studies with the colleagues in the laboratory and trying to find inhibitors to the PCK2. Okay, our fourth speaker tonight, is Dr. Sidang Wang. So we call him Sid. So Sid was born in China and grew up there and decided to come to the U.S. to study when he was 20. So he did his undergrad in molecular biology at Boston University. Then he did his PhD, so he started East Coast, went West Coast to UCSF to study with Aaron O'Shea, working on something called phosphate-responsive signaling in yeast. And then West Coast, flew over and went all the way to the Netherlands, where he was a postdoc for 8 years at the Netherlands Cancer Institute in Amsterdam with the famous professor René Bernards. And he was using functional genomics to study disease mechanism and identify biomarkers of drug responsiveness to targeted cancer therapy. We recruited him in 2013 here at McGill. He's been a great colleague. He's now collaborating with almost everyone in the Cancer Center, and he's continuing his research. And tonight he's going to talk to you about the novel work he's done working on lung cancer. Sid, welcome.
Well, thank you, Nicole. So I flew around the world and finally come back to Montreal. I feel like at home, really. It's been past an amazing almost 3 years. So I'm going to tell you some of the work I've been doing in my lab and with focus to identify effective treatment strategies to for treating relapsing patients, including lung cancer patients. So I thought I would start with this very Asian quote by an Asian Chinese military astrologist or philosopher. He says, "If you know your enemies or know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles." So this is more than 2,000 years old quotes, but this principle still applies for our battles we pit against cancer. So we know quite well now about ourselves, right? We know normal cells have limited cell divisions, has limited lifespan. In cancer cells, when they acquire the DNA mutations, now we know the cancer is genetic disease. Those mutations cause cancer, will cause these cells to grow out of control, unlimited cell divisions, and with a rapid cell division rate. So as you heard from Dr. Cohen, the first generation of cancer treatments are conventional chemotherapies are used to treat cancers because of their ability to kill the cells that are dividing very rapidly. However, because this ability, it also causes an unwanted side effect because it doesn't discriminate the cells, normal cells are also dividing very fast, such as in mouth and stomach or the hair follicles. So the new generation of targeted therapies, as Dr. Cohen has alluded to, these are new class of drugs that specifically target the DNA mutations that cause the cancer. Because these mutations are not present in normal tissues, therefore such agents spare normal tissues, minimize the off-target effects, toxicities. So therefore, it's very important to identify what are the genetic drivers, so-called. These are the DNA mutations that cause cancers. As Dr. Cohen also alluded to you, we now, after 30 years hard work, fundamental researchers, as well as collaboration with clinician researchers, we now know non-small cell lung cancer, which I'm going to focus to, is a very heterogeneous disease. And these are driven by many oncogenic drivers, mutations that define different subset of lung cancer patients. We now know our enemy well, more than before. We can now design target therapies. These are just some examples that specifically against those oncogenic mutations cause different subtype cancers. For example, as Dr. Cohen also told you about, the inhibitors against this gene called EGFR, as well as ALK, has been approved by FDA to treat this subtype patients. And they work very well. So this is one large study recently published looking at survival of about 1,000 lung cancer patients. In the vertical axis is the percentage of patients surviving. In the horizontal axis is the time, the years, starting from the treatment. The yellow line represent the patients that treated with target therapy, where the dark blue are the lines represent patients that treated with the conventional therapy. As you can see, over the course of 5 years, patients that treated with target therapy far survive more better than a patient with a conventional chemotherapy, indicating this effectiveness of drugs. And we will expect actually this line separation would be even better when there are more of the target therapy has been improved in the future. Just to zoom in one example here, this is one case. It's a CT scan of a non-small cell lung cancer patient whose tumor is caused by ALK translocation. And this patient has been treated with drugs quizartinib, which is specifically target this oncogenic drivers. On the left side, you can see, as indicated in this red box, you can see here, the gray matters in the red box was the cancer tissues, the tumor tissues. Within 8 weeks of treatment, you can see all the white matters disappear because cancer cells have been destroyed by the drugs. So this is really effective. Unfortunately, the patient relapsed. That's because they developed the drug resistance, where the tumor no longer responds to the same inhibitors. And you can see the gray matters came back in the box. And this not just happened to this patient. It happens for almost all the patients who initially responded. Some respond longer, some respond shorter. So that's why it's very important to understand what caused the drug resistance. In some situation, you can imagine you have a tumor tissue, all the cancer cells have the same oncogenic driver mutations, they are all sensitive to the drug inhibition. However, during the drug selection, very small percent of tumor cells might acquire additional genetic alterations. This can be DNA mutations or change in the gene expression, so more or less of certain gene expressions. And these cells will now become resistant to the drugs. And they will continue to grow out, and that's the reason you cause relapse in the cancer patients. In some cases, you can imagine, even though majority of cancer cells are sensitive to the drug treatment, there are very few percentages of tumor cells that acquire already exist, that are already resistant to the same drugs. So with the drug treatment, these small population will be selected, and they will completely outgrow, and that will cause the relapse in patients. So in order to eradicate those resistant tumors, these are new enemies, we have to know them better. So we have to understand what are the driving molecular mechanisms, the genetic alteration that causing the resistance. So to study that, one way to study that is to compare the tumor samples from the same patients before the drug resistance, and then the patient had relapsed, the tumor had developed drug resistance from the same tumor, because that will allow us to compare the genetic variants between those two types of tumor from the same patients, with a goal to identify what are new genetic alterations that are only present in the resistant tumors. And presumably, some of those alterations will cause the resistance. Now, as Dr. Collins said, that sometimes the biopsy is difficult, so this is always very challenging to do so. In a laboratory, we can perform the same analysis with the experimental model, such as cancer cells in tissue cultures, dishes, or animal models with tumor that recapitulate the human models of human tumors, and perform the same analysis. So one challenge is actually how do you tease out which alteration actually causing the resistance? Because if you look at that mutation in cancers, there are hundreds of them. Not all of them will cause resistance. Some will be a bystander called passengers. So in addition, we know there are more than 20,000 genes in our cells. Some of the genes we know, based on our research study, has been linked to cause drug resistance, but we do not know for all the 20,000 genes. Therefore, another approach to complement this approach that I mentioned is by use unbiased screening approach, where we use various genetics tools that allow us to modify the gene functions. We do this experiment model, of course, in the cancer cells or mouse models. Start with drug-sensitive models, and we can create different variants. Some of them will be sensitive, some of them be resistant because you change the gene expressions. And we apply the drug selection to select for those only resistant to the drugs. And this will allow us to identify which genes that cause resistance once we modify it. Of course, this approach requires validation using in the clinic by looking whether or not those genes are indeed altered in the tumors that confer resistance in cancer patients. Now, I just told you there are more than 20,000 genes. If you do this one by one, we are losing the time, right? It's not feasible. So in my laboratory, we have this method we can actually look at all genes at once. So this is called high-throughput barcode screening, where we deliver those tools at one go using engineer very safe virus. So these are engineered so that way the virus will be terminated once you infect one cells. And of course, all experiments done in very safely controlled environments will be safe to researchers, but also for the public. What's important is that we can do an experiment in a way that one virus carries one genetic tool that can, unique genetic tool that can modify one unique gene in one cell. Sorry. So because these tools are unique, the service is actually molecular barcode in a way that when these virus or these genetic tools modify one cell, at the same time, these tools also label the cells it is modifying. So it's called genetic marker. Illustrate here is different colors. Because the smart barcodes will allow us to identify in the future what happened to the cells, which gene is being modified. So once we modify these cells, we divide the cells into two identical populations, culturally in the absence of the cancer drugs or in the presence of the cancer drugs. And then we have a way to actually decode these barcodes from the whole population in one go, in two populations. Just like going shopping in the supermarket, no matter how many products you buy in the basket, no matter how you messed up, at the end you scan them, you know what you buy, right? So that's how we do it. So if a modification of the genes that confer the resistance, these cells will be grow out. Therefore, the barcode will be enriched in the presence of drugs. Conversely, if modification of gene causes a toxicity in the cells, in the presence of the drugs, these barcodes will be depleted when you compare before and after treatment. So just one word about resistance screen. We tend to start with sensitive cancer cells, models, because our goal is to identify the gene whose modification can confer resistance. So that's quite simple. And we tend to use a genetic genome-wide tools that covers all the 20,000 genes that can either suppress the gene expression, called the induced gene expression, because that will allow us to unbiased identify the normal biomarkers that can modulate drug resistance. Conversely, for sensitization screen, we start with the cancer cells that are resistant to the drugs. And we tend to use genetic tools that actually can suppress the gene expression in certain subset of genes. For example, in my laboratory, we collect, construct a subset of the genes, the tools that can actually inhibit targets or FDA-approved drugs, which mimic the drug action, right? And the rationale behind it is that if we identify the target, when it's suppressed, can enhance the drug response, can revert drug resistance. We already have approved drugs that we can combine, the drug two combined to drug one. And because these drugs approved are known to be safe to use to treat cancer patients or patients, this combination will have the highest chance to lead to clinical trial. So using these tools, I've been focusing on drug-resistant mechanism in subtype of non-small cell lung cancers. These are the alteration in the group of genes that encodes, include EGFR and ALK, which Dr. Cohen has alluded to. These are, in normal cells, those proteins are cell surface receptors. What they do is they basically sense the environmental conditions, such as growth factors, growth conditions, and lead to the change inside the cells. Appropriate gene expression changes and lead to normal survival and cell growth. In cancers, these drivers have been mutated in a way that they're already hyperactive. Even in the absence of signals, they constantly feed in the signal to the cells and tell cells to grow, and that they do control the survival and the growth. So the drugs in a clinic or the clinical study are to inhibit those oncogenic proteins, therefore shut down the cancer cell growth. As I told you earlier, almost all the patients develop resistance. Cancer cell has a way to bypass the inhibition of those inhibitors. So my research goal is to identify what are the novel genes, also biomarkers can serve, that control the drug responses. And more important as well, what are the effective treatment options can overcome such resistance. So I've been using the cell line models. These are cell line models that derive from the patient tumors. They harbor the corresponding oncogenic mutations, and these cell lines are also very sensitive to drug treatments. So by using resistance screen I mentioned to you earlier, a few years ago now, we have identified this gene called MET12. If the cell has lost this expression of genes, it will confer resistance to ALK inhibitor or inhibitor against EGFR. Just show you one example how we study this in laboratory. This is called growth assays, where we see the cancer cells in the tissue culture dishes and then culture in the presence or absence of drugs. After long-term culturing, we stop the experiments, we fix the cells, we stain them, and we take a picture. And what you see in here, the darker the color is, it's more cell growing, which is untreated population. And as you can see, when you treat those cells with the drugs, you see very little cell remain because they're white. Now, if you lose MET12, as you can see, clearly MET12 loss cancer cells are very resistant to these drugs. Similarly, we recently have identified another gene called SMARCE1. If the cell had lost SMARCE1, it also confers drug resistance to multiple drugs used in lung cancer patients. Now, these are interesting molecules that have been documented across different human cancers, but a link between their alteration to tumorigenesis or drug resistance has been found. So there's no way to understand what actually the mechanism. By performing the reverse screen I mentioned earlier, we were able to identify the underlying mechanism in the sense that loss proteins actually activate alternative surface receptors, bypass the one that drugs inhibiting. And these include EGFR, which is not a receptor tyrosine kinase, as well as the other TGF-beta receptor. These are the main drivers that have been documented in literature as well that can lead to oncogenesis when they're mutated. Now, these are, I guess, as Sun Tzu would say, the friend of enemy is our enemy, right? So by targeting those enemies' friends, we should be able to overcome this resistance. Indeed, we can model this in tissue culture. You can see when we treat the cells with the inhibitor against TGF-beta receptor here in the blue, by itself it doesn't do anything to the cancer cells. But if you now combine the quizartamine, the first drugs, and the second drugs, you can see clearly can reverse resistance. Similarly, that's what we found as well for the other gene we found, the SMARCE1. If you now combine the EGFR inhibitor plus the quizartamine, that can reverse the resistant phenotype. So this is really the beginning of the work. Obviously, it needs to be validated in patients. But I just want to emphasize again, for example, to your left here, both the drugs are being proved to actually treat lung cancer patients for different reasons. So our study suggests that perhaps in the patient who have loss or deficient in SMARCE1 can also be benefit for this combination treatment. So I hope I convince you this approach using unbiased genetic screening approach we call functional genetic approach that can actually lead to identify normal biomarkers and potentially effective treatment options. Of course, this will be validated in animal models as well as the patients, and hopefully that will lead to biomarker and structure-driven clinical trials. So I just want to end with an example that I was involved, initiated when I was postdoc research. This is actually in colon cancer. We're looking for the drug treatment options for subtype of colon cancer patients that are caused by BRAF mutations. And those patients are resistant to conventional chemo. They are resistant to the BRAF inhibitor. So basically, nothing works. So using the same approach, we actually identify a combination treatment using two FDA-approved drugs. And that was validated in animal models. You don't have to read the details. I just want to tell you the quick timelines. And we published that work the next year soon because our publications that had led to a multi-center clinical trials in the same year. And first patient was actually enrolled in our center where I trained as a postdoc fellows. And early next year, we actually documented first responder patients. So I'm actually very pleased to tell you that phase one trial of this part has been completed with very promising results. Remember, those patients actually do not respond. They progress with any treatment. So in fact, I would say I remember the numbers about 75 patients responded or higher. So that's very encouraging. Of course, we need more patients. The phase two will tell us. So with that, I want to thank my former supervisor in Holland, where I did my training, Renee Bernards, as well as my very talented students who we collaborate with. And I came to McGill about 2.5 years ago with great support from the department, as well as Goodman Cancer Center. I feel like at home. And the work we presented here are the work of my postdoc, Andreas Papadakis, as well as my student, Yi Bo Shit. And these are my funding agents, and I thank you for your attention. Thank you.
So we come to the last talk in tonight's lung cancer series. And as you know, we love to hear from the patients about how they deal with their disease and essentially how they keep the faith and keep going. And we have such a patient tonight. Dr. Terry Tannenbaum is a woman who was diagnosed with lung cancer in January 2014. I said Dr. Tannenbaum because she is a physician. She's a specialist physician in public health. She obtained her medical degree, not at McGill, at the University of Calgary, but she came to do family medicine at McGill and specialize in public health at the University of Massachusetts, where she obtained a master's in public health. She spent quite some time working as the head of the health protection, deputy public health director, and as interim public health director. So she knows quite a bit about public health. She's an associate professor in the Faculty of Medicine here at McGill University, and she has a Master's of Management from McGill. And she's a recognized expert in public health tuberculosis control, and she was awarded the Queen's Jubilee Medal in 2002 for her contribution to public health. Please welcome Dr. Terry Tannenbaum.
Appreciated that opportunity. I'll use this. Oh, okay. So I was diagnosed with lung cancer in January of 2014. Okay, that one's mine. Yeah, thanks. I was 61 at the time, and I considered myself to be in perfectly good health. And I always thought that I'd live to be 90, like so many of my older, my relatives, my family. I was working full-time, and I just loved my job. I'm a public health physician, as you were told, and I was in charge of health protection at the Montreal Health Department at the time. This means I was in charge of things like HIV prevention or tuberculosis control or vaccination programs. My unit was also in charge of investigating outbreaks, and my childhood heroine had been Nancy Drew. So if any of you remember that, but this was then I finally had my experience to be a detective. I was happily married. I'm still happily married with two children. And, you know, we were reaching that point where we were starting to think about retirement, what we wanted to do next, what was the next phase in our life. Then during the year of 2013, I started just having some abnormal lab tests. I felt fine, but the doctor just couldn't explain these test results, and so she ordered a CT scan of my chest and abdomen. And then in January of 2014, I just developed an abscess in my foot. As soon as the abscess was diagnosed and drained, all the lab results came back to normal. So I thought this was the end of the story. But the CT scan happened to be booked the next day, and we decided I might as well go ahead and have it. I remember that the CT took place late in the afternoon, and I was walking down an empty corridor after the exam. I was with my husband, who's also a doctor, and he'd been sitting with the radiologist during the exam. So I looked at him and I said, well, I guess the CT's normal. It just never occurred to me that it would be anything but normal. And he said, no, there's something in your chest. And I just stopped short and I just stared at him. And that's the moment when my life changed. It was, I went from being, you know, independent, a full-time physician, life was good, to becoming a full-time patient. And switching careers where now I had to see how I was going to keep myself alive. I was dependent on my healthcare team, on my family and my friends, and I felt like everything I treasured was just suddenly taken out from me. And my life now had to revolve around having cancer. We learned that the tumor wasn't operable, but it hadn't spread outside the chest cavity. Okay, I said, I'm very optimistic. We're going to beat this. I'm going to have chemotherapy. I'm going to have radiotherapy. And then maybe I'll be able to have surgery and be cured. And initially things went well. I felt fine. I felt absolutely fine. I tolerated the chemo and the radiation without any problems. I had wonderful family and friends who rallied around to take care of us. So we were really optimistic. But the plan to be cured didn't happen. The follow-up scan showed that the cancer had now spread to my liver and my brain. And now I had stage 4 lung cancer, and as you've seen, this is not something you want to have. So that was our second crisis, realizing that there wasn't going to be a cure. It made us feel like we were living suddenly in a different reality, and it was just out of sync of the world as we knew it. We were in a world that really only other families that have gone through this kind of illnesses, I think, can understand. Since then, having cancer is something that's just always with me. Wherever I go, it's like the monkey that's sitting on your shoulder. It's always there, it's always in my mind, and it doesn't go away. And it means there's no such thing as long-term planning now. You know, 3 months is a long time. A year is forever. It means to me that I probably won't be here for some of the life events that are so important to us, weddings, grandchildren, the things that we look forward to, and that I might be leaving the people I love the most before I'm ready to say goodbye. People ask me if I'm angry. I can't say that I feel angry that I have cancer. I feel sad. I feel sad because of things that I might be missing that I really wanted to be here for. It's been nearly 2 years now, though, since my diagnosis. Excuse me. And my life has been much of a roller coaster. Initially, I had a lot of complications of the cancer. I had inflammation in my lung from the radiation and inflammation around the lining of my heart. I had a broken backbone, and I also had a lung clot to my leg. A blood clot in my leg, I mean, called a deep vein down thrombosis. It was the winter of 2015 that was probably the hardest. I was having a lot of back pain that was found to be from a spinal fracture from the cancer. It needed to be surgically stabilized, and this was a long, painful ordeal. I'm still having physiotherapy from the CLFC. I also learned that I had spread to the brain, and I had to have something called whole brain radiotherapy. These were both very hard to go through, especially the whole brain radiotherapy. I lost my hair for the first time, and I suffered from an unbearable fatigue. Cancer-related fatigue is so disabling. It never occurred to me how disabling this would be. There were days when I couldn't get out of bed, and it was the only time, and the first time, that I felt depressed and really wondered if I wanted to go on, if this is what it meant. But, you know, but I somehow managed to recover from each one of those events, including the fatigue and the depression. I can't say I'm as strong and as independent as I was before I got sick, but I can walk the hills in Westmount. I went back to work part-time, and I was dancing at my daughter's wedding. So, but we're also on a roller coaster every time we approach the next CT or the MRI to see whether the treatment's working. We become more and more anxious in the days preceding each test, and the anxiety just gets worse until we get to the results. And then if things are good, we get just immense relief. It's like another few months of feeling good. And the times that it's not been as good results, it's great anxiety and fear and wondering what's going to happen next. I'm fortunate in that my tumor has the ALK rearrangement. These were one of the things that we were talked about earlier. So that means that there's these drugs called ALK inhibitors that are available. What I don't think you mentioned is that they're also pills, so it means I don't have to go in for injections. And they're really relatively few side effects, some GI problems, but no hair loss and none of the really bad side effects of chemotherapy. And I had read about patients who were doing well after 3 years on the ALK inhibitors. So again, I said, okay, I can do this, you know, that's great. But in my case, that's not what happened. The first two of the ALK inhibitors each lasted a few months, And then I broke through and developed resistance. And this is, from what I've later read, pretty common that it only lasts a few months. I just started the third ALK inhibitor about 2 months ago. Once again, I feel great. It's taken by mouth. It has almost no side effects. My appetite's back. My energy's back. My hair's growing back. I really feel terrific. There's really nothing good about having cancer. But there have been numerous wonderful services available to cancer patients. And my husband and I have taken advantage of them all. There's the staff at the Jewish General, the staff from the CLSC, the psychiatry services, palliative care, and our rabbi. And we rely on our providers, not only for their expertise, but also for their empathy and understanding of what we're going through. They really helped us when it came to talking to our family. Talking to family and friends about cancer is very difficult, but we felt like it had to be done. But otherwise, it was like having the elephant in the room. And so having them guide us through this has been really helpful. I also have a community support group of other lung cancer patients, and some of them are here this evening. I really welcome their presence tonight. And as much as my family and friends have tried to help me, cancer is a lonely disease. This community has been very important because nobody except other cancer patients really understand what we're going through. I asked some of these patients if there was anything they wanted me to say tonight. And what they talked about was the stigma around lung cancer. When I tell people I have lung cancer, inevitably the comment is, but you don't smoke. You know, nobody deserves to have lung cancer, whether they smoked or not. And no one should have to feel ashamed of such a terrible illness. And why doesn't lung cancer receive its own share of research funding? Why don't we see walks for lung cancer like we do for breast cancer? And why don't we see a lot of people wearing green ribbons? You know, how many of you even knew that November was Lung Cancer Month? It's the leading cause of death, as Dr. Agalnik said, from cancer for men and women in Canada, and there has to be more funding for lung cancer. I'm lucky because I'm benefiting from the advances in the cancer treatment. There are many more patients out there who don't even have access to testing, never mind to the drugs. I'm currently on a treatment that's keeping the cancer from spreading. I don't know whether this is going to last for 3 months or hopefully for a few years. But the public forum series is called Fighting Cancer with Knowledge and Hope. What's giving us hope is knowing that there are other drugs that we can take, that we're never really at the end of the line. And this is what we need to hear, the lung cancer patients, that there are drugs that are being developed. Lots of money is being spent to have those drugs so that we can all grow old. Thank you very much.
Okay, so if the speakers would come to the table in the front, and if I can have some help collecting the cue cards with questions. In a few moments, we'll basically have them answer the questions that you have. So there'll be also, as you exit, there'll be flyers for the conference next week up here in the front and as you exit up in the on the sixth floor. Please. Okay, so let's start with the first question that's directed to Dr. Wang. Do cancer cells die or hide during regression? How can you prove they die versus hide on a CT scan? And why do they reappear in the in the same area.
Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm not a physician, so that's a bit difficult to answer, but I think they die, right? Because from the CT scan, that's where you look at the tissues, the tumor tissues. Is it the question? Sorry, I didn't quite get.
So
the
how
part.
Can you prove that they die versus hide?
Hiding,
looking
I see.
At a CT scan.
Yeah, please.
So clearly, when cancer comes back in an area where we know cancer existed before, we would have to think that the cancer cells, at least not all of them, die. And it's one could say that they're hiding. It's just simply because our tests are not perfect, and we're not able to see them even with the best of our scans. But these are the cells that are coming back to cause problems in the future.
But I think majority will be dying, right, from during the progression. So that's what resistance happens. So only very small percentage of cell were hiding, which we cannot detect, and eventually come back. So,
okay. Should the children of patients who have died from non-small cell lung cancer worry that they will get lung cancer? That's a good one.
So the answer today would be no. It's not a, even though we talk about genetic mechanisms of the disease, it's not a genetic hereditary disease. It's very rare to have a significant family history. And most patients, unfortunately, did smoke, and so you can find a direct link to that. I guess if people grew up and had certain exposures, like to significant exposure to asbestos, and there was something in the house, or they lived near a mine or something like that, then perhaps the rest of the family should be tested, but usually no.
How do you choose what kind of biopsy, EBUS versus needle biopsy, to do?
So it's a good question. It's so again, depending on what center you go to and what they have access to, often it's chosen based on what's the most easily accessible and what can also stage the tumor. So if a patient has a small liver lesion with a lung lesion, you would want to prove that the lung lesion is truly the lung cancer also, because that would have quite an implication, knowing that the cancer is spread to the liver. So you'd probably biopsy, get a needle biopsy of the liver to prove it. If it's located in the lung and there's a lymph node that looks large, then you would biopsy the lymph node to show that it is spread, because that would change the stage.
Patients that get repeated CT scans, should they be worrying about overexposure to radiation?
It's a good question. So the answer is yes, too much radiation is linked to probably cancer, but it would occur much later in life, and you have to balance the risk versus the benefits. A lot of patients don't want to wait also to get their scans to find out if they're benefiting from treatments. So often you do end up ordering more scans than necessary. Often if a patient is stable after a while, you may start to do them less often.
For you, Dr. Agolnik, asbestos cancer, although more rare, what differences are there in statistics between exposed individuals from workplace sources versus non-protected spouses of these workers?
So asbestos exposure can cause a lot of different types of lung diseases. Mesothelioma is the most common type, not the most common, but it's a common type of cancer that's associated with asbestos. But patients who are exposed to asbestos are also at risk of getting regular lung cancer. And it's not only the person himself who worked in asbestos, but there is documentation and there are a lot of different stories of patients' family or people's family members. So, for example, wives of husbands who worked in mines, who would then come home and the wives would clean their clothes, that they would get exposed to asbestos and eventually develop mesothelioma. But the cancers often occur decades later. So when we see patients, we often try to take a very detailed history to find out, as a teenager, if they worked somewhere. It could have been in the ship mining mining or the shipbuilding fields. It could also be a lot of things nowadays have changed, but in the past, plumbers were exposed, electricians were exposed, mechanics who worked with brake pads were exposed. So you really have to go back to when they were a teenager and early career or early jobs.
Why is the incubation time of lung cancer so long before a diagnosis? The corollary to this, and now, if you guys were sleeping during my biochemistry lecture, now you're going to get caught. What causes genetic mutations? Short version.
Question for Sid.
Well, we know the environmental factors. They're carcinogens that cause DNA damages. And when it's not repaired, it will cause mutations, right? So that's what cancer does.
Okay. Immunotherapy is available now. Is it expensive?
Well, yes, the treatments are very expensive. But when we say available to patients for now, access to these drugs are either in the context of a clinical trial, and there's also special access programs where we have, at least for now, free access, or rather free drug, for selected patients with non-small cell lung cancer. Yes, these are very expensive drugs, costing tens of thousands of dollars, even going to hundreds of thousands of dollars for patients who are going to be on these drugs for a long period of time.
Are they covered by the RIMQ?
They're not approved by Health Canada yet. That's coming very soon. So once that's approved, then each of the provincial reimbursement bodies will have to make a decision about whether or not they're going to be able to afford and reimburse these drugs for our patients. But this is a challenge ahead, no doubt, because this is not new. Other drugs are also expensive, and there are many drugs that we have to pay for. So this is going to be a question for society, whether or not we can afford all these drugs for our patients and how we're going to be able to pay for them. But
I just want to add just one thing.
Yeah.
It's actually quite complicated because it's an intravenous treatment, and all intravenous treatments that are given in the hospital are covered by the government. You know, patients aren't allowed to pay for treatments in hospitals. So once they become accepted by Health Canada, it will be up to the province to decide whether or not they will reimburse it. If they don't decide to reimburse it, then it will probably only be available to people who either can pay for it or people with insurance who can go to private clinics.
In the same line of thought, can immunotherapy also be used for treatments of small cell lung cancer?
So there is very good data to suggest, there's early data to suggest that it's actually can be successful in both small cell and even diseases like mesothelioma. So I would encourage everyone, if they're interested, to come to the immunotherapy talk next week at the Jewish General Hospital, free public lecture.
Emma, you're still here. Is PKC2 available in normal cells?
Yes, it is expressed in normal cells, and it was actually studied originally in the liver, and it's involved in making glucose in the liver, but it's only really just we started to be studied in cancer cells.
Thank you. Are molecular profiles of lung cancer specific to lung only, or do they appear in other cancers too?
So that's a good question. So when we talk about genetic changes, we're talking about specific mutations. There's some mutations that are unique to lung cancer or non-small cell lung cancer. There's other mutations or rearrangements like the ALK rearrangement that is seen in lung cancer but could also be seen in other diseases like lymphomas.
How is the treatment different for primary source lung cancer as opposed to lung cancer that has spread from a different area?
I'm not sure we understand the question.
I think you mentioned that, or one of the two of you mentioned that we don't treat metastatic patients exactly in the same way as we do patients showing a primary.
Right, you treat where the cancer is originally from. So you don't treat if there's a colon cancer in the lung, you treat it as a colon cancer. And the same thing if it's a breast cancer that spread to the lung. And if it's a lung cancer that's spread elsewhere in the body, then you treat it as a lung cancer. But all the different cancers are treated differently.
Yeah. Dr. Cohen, what percentage of tumors tested in non-small cell lung cancer have one of the three mutations and thus would respond to targeted therapies currently available?
That's also a very good question. So these mutations are relatively rare. So, for example, EGFR mutations are present in about 15% of our patients. But this is a prevalence rate in the Caucasian population. In Asian populations, that number could be higher. So that's for EGFR. For ALK, it's even more rare. It's believed to occur in about 4% of lung cancer patients.
Do circulating tumor cells in metastatic patients have the same mutations as the primary tumor? I told you should have listened during my biochemistry lectures.
That's also a very good question. Are there scientists in the room? In fact, this is an area that is still being studied, but there is studies that have been done that have shown that that in fact these mutations could be detected in circulating tumor cells or in the blood, which would make it easier for us to be able to detect these mutations for different reasons, including or even avoiding a situation where we may have to rebiopsy a patient. So instead of rebiopsying a patient, taking a blood test, obviously if we can accomplish that, that would be very good. But so far, so good.
The next question, I think, is really a good one as well. What is the future or treatment for patients who don't have any of the mutations that you've been discussing tonight?
So I think that the promising new treatment is immunotherapy. And the data actually shows that it probably works better in the patients without the mutations. The patients with the mutations tend to be the ones who never smoked. And the immunotherapies work, for some reason, better in the patients who have multiple mutations and probably who had a more extensive smoking history.
Emma, to the lady from the UK. Based on your research, would you generally conclude that less sugar intake is better in preventing cancer or cancer growth?
It's a really good question. I mean, unfortunately, our bodies are so good at regulating the amount of glucose in our blood, so they'll keep the glucose level in the blood constant whether you eat less sugar or not. So, yeah, it's you can still eat cake. So, Morag just mentioned that one of the ways of screening for cancer is to use PET scans. And if a cancer cell takes up a lot of glucose, you can see it on a PET scan. But if it's using another nutrient, such as glutamine, you wouldn't be able to see the cancer on the PET scan. So it'd be important to develop different ways of screening for those tumors.
The important thing is if you treat some cancers, that when they become resistant, you use the different... They don't use glucose anymore, so they maybe use glutamine. And so although you're treated with a PET scan and everybody's, wow, we don't see it anymore, sometimes the tumor switched and started to use another component that it needs for energy. And that's why this metabolomics, this study of metabolism, is a really exciting area, particularly for treatment and early diagnosis and following how the treatments can be effective.
Dr. Agulnik, a very pointed question. There was a lot of controversy over low-dose helical CT scans when the study was published in 2011. Is it still the case now?
So there are quite a few issues concerning the low-dose CT screening. First of all, you have to choose the right group of patients. You have to make sure you can get a low-dose CT scan, and it's only recent that this has been available in Quebec. And even if you go to different centers in the States, it's not all regulated on how they do CT scans. So even though it says low dose, one of them may be significantly higher amount of radiation than another. And then the question was always, are you finding lung cancers, such early ones that wouldn't have caused problems for many years, or are you actually making a big difference? And so when the study initially came out that they found more lung cancers in one group versus another, that was initially, would it really make a difference? I think that the mortality was shown to decrease, so it does make a difference. But there is a huge amount, a huge expense associated with this in getting routine scans done, at least 3 scans regularly for a large group of people. And it took a while for the U.S. agencies to agree to pay for the scans. I don't know what we're going to do in Canada and Quebec yet, but we order them and we do them in our patients when we see them, but it's not routinely done yet.
Have all genes responsible for lung cancer been identified at this time?
No.
When a biopsy is done, is the genetic profile of the tumor always done?
So it depends what you mean by the genetic profile. So Dr. Cohen mentioned there are a lot of different mutations. There's 2 right now, or 3 that we can treat, which is the EGFR, the ALK, and even, which you didn't mention, the ROS1. The EGFR and ALK are routinely done. The other ones are not yet routinely done, but they will be hopefully in the future when we start doing a genomic panel and getting all the results, kind of a printout of your personal cancer, explaining what the genetic makeup is and what treatments may be best. So hopefully that's the future. There are some private companies in the States that do that, Foundation Medicine. You can send your tumor, and it will give you a 4-page summary. Half of them you've never heard of, and they actually have disclaimers, different categories. Category 1, we can treat. 2, maybe we can treat. 3, we're not sure what this means. 4, we don't even know if this is real or not. So it's still a whole new science and a whole new thing that we're starting to do.
I think this one's very important. Heavy smokers who have stopped for 5, 10, or 15 years, does their risk of getting lung cancer go down significantly?
So yes, the risk of lung cancer definitely goes down. It probably doesn't go down to a person who never smoked. There was a study that showed that people who quit smoking before age 30 can go down to almost the equivalent as a non-smoker. But regardless of lung cancer risk, there's so many other risks associated with smoking, be it heart disease, emphysema. So the benefits of quitting smoking, it's always important at whatever age.
Are cancer stem cells, maybe this should be directed at you, are cancer stem cells more resistant?